Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Jov Parrish, who assesses the growing number of civilian deaths and injuries in Afghanistan resulting from the four-week-long U.S. bombing campaign there. Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation magazine, who discusses the anthrax attack and the recognition that the U.S. public health system is totally unprepared for a biological attack after two decades of underfunding. And William Bloom, author of Rogue State, a guide to the world's only superpower, who examines the history of U.S. Middle East policy in light of the September 11th terrorist attacks. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While Afghanistan is now under siege by the U.S. and British military, just a few years ago, the repressive Taliban regime was the darling of Western oil companies eager to build a $2 billion natural gas pipeline through Central Asia. U.S.-based UNICAL was the most aggressive suitor of the Taliban. The oil giant formed a consortium of six energy companies to build a pipeline and tap $3 billion in oil and gas reserves from the former Soviet republics of Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. According to Mother Jones magazine, UNICAL sought support from the Taliban and the rebel Northern Alliance. But the company spent most of its lobbying effort on the Taliban, which were on the receiving end of non-cash bonus payments as a means of keeping the pipeline project moving. In 1997, a Taliban delegation visited UNICAL's offices in Sugarland, Texas, for a meeting with company executives. Soon afterwards, the Taliban's mining minister met with top U.S. State Department officials, a visit that was arranged by UNICAL. In early 1998, the U.S. Department of Energy announced that UNICAL and the Taliban signed a deal for an 890-mile natural gas pipeline, but the project fell apart in August of 1998 after the U.S. launched cruise missiles into Afghanistan and Sudan in retaliation for the bombing of two American embassies in Africa. The bombings were linked to associates of Osama bin Laden. UNICAL insists that it has no plans for a new pipeline in Afghanistan, but there is plenty of talk that the company wants to revive its pipeline project in Central Asia. The World Press Review magazine reports that the African nation of Lesotho is prosecuting corruption charges against four major European and Canadian construction contractors for offering bribes to a major development official. According to the indictment, the four engineering firms paid Masufa Soleil, head of the Lesotho Highlands Development Authority, $4.2 million in bribes for contracts in the massive $1.4 billion dam-building program. Corruption trials are extremely rare in Africa, where multinational corporations have often worked hand-in-hand with corrupt regimes, such as Zaire's former strongman Mobutu Sese Seko. Now Lesotho's Attorney General, Fine Mema, declares, "People are quick to point the finger at Africa, but someone is taking the money and someone is paying for it, and they must be held accountable too." Already, Sole, the development official, has pleaded not guilty to 16 counts of bribery and fraud that date back to 1991. So far, the government of Lesotho has the backing of the European Union and the World Bank in pressing charges against the corrupt companies. At first, the World Bank, which has lent $140 million to the dam project, was reluctant to support the prosecution out of fear that the development scheme might fall apart. But as this case demonstrates, corruption in developing nations cannot be blamed solely on unscrupulous bureaucrats. Multinational corporations and their corrupt behavior accounts for an important part of the problem. Montana's Rocky Mountain Font is one of the most pristine wilderness areas south of Alaska. The area is known as a major breeding ground for grizzly bears and is home to one of America's biggest herds of bighorn sheep. Like the Arctic National Refuge, the Rocky Mountain Font is under attack from energy corporations. A Canadian company, StarTech Energy, is planning to drill three natural gas wells in the wilderness area to tap an estimated 5 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. The land is under the purview of the Federal Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. According to Forest Magazine, StarTech has released a development plan that includes constructing a road that would rise 2,000 vertical feet, laying a natural gas pipeline alongside the new road, and bringing in 100 semi-trailers full of equipment to sink its wells. Now BLM officials say it is powerless to stop the energy project, even though the granting of new oil and gas leases was banned in nearby wilderness lands. The reason, they say, is that the StarTech lease arrangements date back to the early 1970s. Activist Dan Bennett of the Montana Wilderness Association wants the federal government to throw out the old leases because they were granted without the company filing an environmental impact statement. In the near term, conservationists are worried what the natural gas pipeline will do to disturb grizzly bear habitat. Longer term, environmentalists are watching this case closely to see what precedents are set in the struggle between wilderness preservation and energy exploration. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Jeff Wignall.
Since the U.S. bombing campaign began against Afghanistan's Taliban government on October 7th, reports of a growing number of civilian deaths and injuries resulting from America's bombs, cluster bombs, and missiles have made news across the world. But because many U.S. media outlets have decided not to focus attention on this issue, people in a number of Middle Eastern and Western European nations know more about the consequences of our military action than most Americans. According to independent observers, U.S. airstrikes have destroyed numerous non-military targets, including a United Nations compound, a hotel, mosques, schools, and dozens of homes and shops. Inexplicably, U.S. bombs hit food warehouses operated by the Red Cross, not once, but twice in 10 days. The Pentagon also destroyed the home of Taliban leader Muhammad Omar, killing his elderly stepfather and 10-year-old son. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jav Parrish, a columnist with WorkingForChange.com, who examines the growing civilian death toll in Afghanistan and the effect it may have on international support for the U.S. war against terrorism.
There is an enormous amount of difficulty in determining exactly what the extent of civilian casualties or damage to the sorts of infrastructure that civilians need to survive, what that damage is in Afghanistan. And there are reasons why it is both in the interest of the Pentagon and the White House and in the interest of the Taliban, and for that matter in the interest of the Pakistani government, which is where a number of these refugees and aid workers are staggering across the border, assuming they can survive the gauntlet of abusive border guards with guns and truncheons and whatnot that's trying to keep people from getting into Pakistan. There are a lot of reasons why these folks want to underemphasize the number of civilian casualties that have been taking place. So the one thing that we do know is that it's probably understated, no matter what we know or what we don't. That being said, the biggest difficulty and sort of the out for a lot of American networks and newspapers has been that these are very difficult to confirm through additional independent sources. You may have one or two people describing what happened in a particular village, but because the Taliban aren't allowing Western reporters in there, because access to the country is very difficult, because the Pentagon is keeping a very tight lid on what they know, even to the point of buying up all of the commercially available satellite maps that are accurate enough to show bodies and destruction from the air raids, we just don't have a lot of confirmed sources. But the ones that we do know are telling us that there are, at minimum, a couple or a few thousand people who have already died, civilians who have died from even the first 2 weeks of airstrikes. And the village of Karam in northern Afghanistan, where U.S. airplanes came and made repeated strikes in the middle of evening prayers, and at least 100 to 200 people died, has probably been the most publicized incident. The Taliban did take Western reporters to that site a couple of days later and showed them the destruction, the Muslim practice of burying their dead very quickly when they die, makes it difficult again to confirm the bodies. But aside from that 100 to 200, there have been a number of other incidents of 10, 20, 100 people at a time dying through some of these raids, and raids in which the Pentagon either claims that there was a military target nearby or that that itself was a military target. And in a lot of these cases, like with Karam, that information has been outdated or simply erroneous. So a lot of this stuff is getting widespread publicity in the Islamic world, and even from English-language media in the U.K. and Europe and other parts of the world, but not so much in the United States.
Tell us a little bit about the obstacles that are standing in the way of U.S. reporters, particularly television journalists, from getting this information to the American people.
Well, the simplest obstacle is that American networks, for whatever reason, have chosen to rely very heavily, almost exclusively, in fact, upon the Pentagon, the State Department, the White House, you know, official government sources for their information in terms of what's going on in Afghanistan. All of the networks at this point do have people on the ground in the Middle East, in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or someplace like that. But again, it's very, very difficult to get the story of somebody who, say, is a refugee who's coming out of Afghanistan, who is an eyewitness, who probably has a much better idea of what has actually happened on the ground than the Pentagon even has. In some of these cases, it's not even necessarily that the Pentagon is lying. They just don't know where their bombs dropped, where it hit when it got onto the ground. And these people's stories are not being treated as credible. So what happens is that the networks, who, you know, all have reporters who are in the Pentagon pool and the White House pool and so forth, are relying upon the information that's released by the Pentagon and are not questioning that information, are not seeking out other sources that might bring that information into question. And, you know, quite aside from the immediate humanitarian crisis, there are two other very serious problems with this. Number one is that especially in the rural and mountainous areas, you have a tremendous humanitarian crisis that's about to set in. Oxfam estimates 7.5 million people that are at risk of starvation this winter. You cannot get to many of the areas in Afghanistan once winter sets in, which it's literally starting to do in the next week or two. The other problem is the public relations problem of, if your goal is over the long term to prevent terrorism, that means preventing people from being sympathetic with terrorists, which means convincing particularly the Islamic world that the United States is not targeting civilians. And when you have a lot of civilian casualties, as are apparently taking place, and certainly the creation of a huge number of refugees, an enormous humanitarian crisis, and the possibility of a lot of people starving to death, a lot of people are going to blame the United States for that.
Is the Bush administration, you think, prepared to stop the bombing and change their strategy in the war against Afghanistan if they think they're losing the battle for public opinion and could feed in to a wider war in places around the globe?
It is very, very easy in any number of ways for this conflagration to escalate out of control. Nuclear weapons in Pakistan is one. The steadily degenerating situation in Israel and Palestine is another one. That's something that the Islamic world is going to react to and is going to associate the United States with as well. So it's a very complex situation. A lot of what's been done so far, I think, has been pretty counterproductive. And if it becomes apparent that it's not working, I would hope that they have the wisdom to reverse course. I think a lot of the rest of the world is already coming to the conclusion that it's pretty urgent for the United States to rethink what it's doing. And I would hope that a bunch of people within the public are watching events and trying to come to independent conclusions as well.
That was journalist Geoff Parrish. His articles can be read in the pages of In These Times magazine, Seattle Weekly, and on the web at workingforchange.com. Every day, more cases of anthrax are discovered among government, media, and postal workers. While the numbers of people affected thus far are still relatively small, the nation's first encounter with biological warfare has called into question the competence of the public health system to deal effectively with this crisis and more serious future threats. Over the last two decades, successive administrations, both Republican and Democrat, have systematically defunded the nation's public health infrastructure. Private, for-profit healthcare institutions with bottom-line philosophies have replaced public hospitals and clinics open to all. The potential danger of fast-spreading epidemics and biological or chemical terrorist attacks has been increased, with many hospitals and local health departments both underfunded and understaffed. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation magazine, who discusses the anthrax attack and the ability of the U.S. public health care system to confront this threat and protect the public from possibly more deadly biological assaults in the future.
The real danger of anthrax is not so much the disease, because it's very treatable once it's identified. What's crucial to both the health and welfare of those who might be exposed and to preventing a large-scale panic is swift reporting, is information, is a channel of communication between the government and the people with credible authoritative information, and is that distribution of medication. And right now, the public health system, as we have seen, has been just a disaster in the response to this. In fact, to the contrary, we've hardly seen physicians or public health officials carry information at all. The principal conduits of information for weeks, ever since the outbreak of this, have been politicians, Attorney General John Ashcroft, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, Dick Gephardt, Dennis Hastert, now Tom Ridge, the former governor of Pennsylvania, now director of Homeland Security. One after another, these politicians, Tommy Thompson, the former governor of Wisconsin, who now is Health and Human Services cabinet member. None of these people are scientists. None of them know what they're talking about. In the case of Tommy Thompson, he really caused the medical profession to rise up in outrage when he suggested that Richard Stevens, the first person to fall victim to these anthrax attacks, might have gotten the disease fishing. You know, there's been a tremendous amount of misinformation. It's because the politicians don't know what they're talking about. At the same time, they've put a lid on, they've really clamped down on the distribution of information from federal science agencies. The staff of the Centers for Disease Control have been told in no uncertain terms not to talk to the press. What's happened is that not only has public health been defunded over the last 20 years, with hospitals closed, with clinics turned into HMOs and all that, but the whole idea of public health and of the authority and credibility of the independent scientific voice, the women and men in lab coats, as the conduits for responsible information to the public, even disturbing information, that has gone by the wayside, and instead it's become just another venue for politicians, who each of whom wants to be tomorrow's Rudolph Giuliani.
Now, we have the specter of future biological and chemical attacks, and I guess the worst-case scenario is that someone gets a hold of smallpox contagion, and that spreads like wildfire through the population, a horrible, nightmarish scenario, but one that would even be worse given the state of our public health care system. Am I right?
Oh, sure. I mean, the fact of the matter is that most major hospitals now, in fact, all major hospitals, all major medical centers, have been forced, because of financial strictures and government cutbacks, to shift to a kind of business model of operations from a public health model. They use what any listeners who are in small business will recognize as just-in-time inventory. This is a business principle where if you run a widget factory, you keep only enough screws and nuts and bolts and widget parts on hand to handle this day's business, because it's considered better for cash flow and all that to not have a big backlog of materials. Well, hospitals now run the same way. And it's not only a matter of medication, where you have only enough Cipro, only enough antibiotics, only enough aspirin, only enough morphine on hand for a normal day's load. You also have only enough nurses, only enough doctors, only enough equipment. I've had some interesting conversations in the last few weeks with really quite experienced emergency management officials, former cabinet secretaries, people like undersecretaries, people like that, who say quite authoritatively that there is not a hospital in the United States that could handle 100 people unexpectedly falling victim to something like smallpox. I mean, the surge capacity is the phrase of art. Is not there. And in the case of smallpox, which would require quarantine, which would require specialized treatment, the strain on the medical system would be huge. And the answer here is not panic about foreign terrorism and contagion. The answer is to look hard at our public health system as a guarantor of national security and as the real indicator of national security, and to realize that we've weakened our own safety as a society and weakened our capacity to deal with not only terrorism but all kinds of other crises, outbreaks of illness and epidemic, disasters. We've weakened our ability to deal civically with these medical crises because it was viewed as an affront to the free market that the medical system should be prepared for emergencies.
That was Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation magazine and a national correspondent for Salon.com. Read Shapiro's article titled Anthrax Anxiety on The Nation magazine's website at www.thenation.com. In the immediate aftermath of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center buildings and the Pentagon on September 11th, the question, "Why do they hate us so much?" was asked by shocked American citizens. That question was repeatedly answered by the Bush administration and a majority of the corporate media by stating that what was under attack was what we stand for, America's freedom and democracy. But while the United States wages its war on terrorism, the media has reluctantly begun to explore that question. Most Americans have forgotten that the CIA covertly aided Islamic fundamentalist groups, or Mujahideen, putting together an army to drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan. Among Washington's allies in that battle was Osama bin Laden. William Bloom left the State Department in 1967 because of his opposition to the U.S. war in Vietnam. He's the author of Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower, and spoke with your reporter Denise Manzari about the history of U.S. Middle East policy in light of the September 11th terrorist attacks.
These journalists have been forced, it seems, to confront the question of why do they hate us so much. I have read articles in the U.S. News and World Report and Time Magazine, in the L.A. Times and the Washington Post and on NPR, which are really remarkable. I wish such coverage would appear during other times, and I wonder how long it'll last. But they've gone past the point of saying that we're attacked because of our freedom. I mean, if that was the case, why would they have attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? Why wouldn't they have attacked the Statue of Liberty? That's the symbol of our freedom, obviously. Now, which is not to say that they give the full reasons. I mean, in my book, I have a list of things done by the U.S. to the Middle East in just the past 20 years, which is much more extensive than you would read or hear in our media. The shooting down of two Libyan planes in 1981, the bombardment of Beirut in 83 and 84, the bombing of Libya in 1986, the bombing and sinking of an Iranian ship in 1987, the shooting down of an Iranian passenger plane in 1988, and I might add that the U.S. naval commander who shot down that plane, when he came back to the States, he was honored. He was given all kinds of awards. Now imagine if we learned that Osama bin Laden, or whomever was responsible for what happened on the 11th, was being given an award by some nation in the Middle East. We would be infuriated. So I'll continue with my list. The shooting down of two more Libyan planes in 1989, the massive bombing of the Iraqi people in 1991, the continuing sanctions and bombings against Iraq, the bombing of Sudan and Afghanistan in 1998, the habitual support of Israel despite its continuous attacks upon the Palestinian people and its use of torture, and our condemnation of the Palestinians for standing up to this or attempting any kind of resistance, the large military and high-tech presence in Islam's holiest land, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere in the Persian Gulf. During the war between Iraq and Iran in the 1980s, the U.S. gave military and intelligence support to both sides hoping to maximize the harm and damage they would do to each other. This is how cynical our policy has been in the Middle East. These are some of the American actions that can turn an Arab or a Muslim into a fanatic, into a terrorist, into a decrier of America, the great Satan.
Israel has, or very recently, pulled out of an area of the West Bank that was previously occupied by the Palestinians. And there is talk of actually granting Palestine its own state by the United States.
Well, this talk of a state of Palestine comes and goes. It has for at least a decade. And the U.S. obviously right now is hoping to win as much support in the Middle East as it can for its actions in Afghanistan. So it's going to say the right things. And it'll give Israel a slap on the wrist, of which there have been many over the years. And they aren't to be taken with any kind of seriousness. I mean, you must keep in mind that if the American government was even partially serious about putting pressure on Israel to change its policies, it would threaten to end or at least cut back sharply on the massive aid we give them, and I never hear or read a word about that. So one cannot take any such comments about Israel coming from Washington with any kind of seriousness.
You wrote an article, Anthrax for Export. U.S. companies sold Iraq the ingredients for a witch's brew in 1998 in the Progressive. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mentioned before in my list of things which people in the Middle East would have reason to hate the U.S. for. During the war between Iran and Iraq from 1980 to 1988, the U.S. was giving aid to both sides to help them inflict maximum damage upon each other. And they gave, in this period, they gave Iraq a whole collection of biological and chemical materials, plus the equipment needed to turn all of this into a viable chemical and biological warfare mechanism. Iraq was set up with all they needed, and we sent them the bacillus for anthrax and the bacillus for E. coli and a whole bunch of other things. There's a whole list of them. These were sent by private American companies with the full approval and knowledge of the Department of Commerce.
That was William Bloom, author of Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower, published by Common Courage Press. For more information, you can contact William Bloom by email at bblum6@aol.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Jeff Wignall, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.